More at MakingCancerHistory.com.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. Well, yesterday, Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said that if a Supreme Court opening occurs next year, he'll hold a vote in the Senate to confirm whoever President Trump nominates. That's in contradiction to what McConnell did during 2016 when he blocked President Obama's Supreme Court nominee from being confirmed. We'll talk about that later in the hour. We're hoping to hear from a Green Party potential candidate for president right now, but this is WMNF in Tampa. He's not shown up yet, so we are going to join Special Counsel Robert Mueller live as he's making a statement in Washington, D.C. This is WMNF in Tampa.
And beyond department policy, we were guided by principles of fairness. It would be unfair to potentially accuse somebody of a crime when there can be no court resolution of the actual charge. So that was Justice Department policy. Those were the principles under which we operated. And from them, we concluded that we would not reach a determination one way or the other about whether the president committed a crime. That is the office's final position. And we will not comment on any other conclusions or hypotheticals about the president. We conducted an independent criminal investigation and reported the results to the Attorney General, as required by department regulations. The Attorney General then concluded that it was appropriate to provide our report to Congress and to the American people. At one point in time, I requested that certain portions of the report be released. The Attorney General preferred to make the entire report public all at once. And we appreciate that the Attorney General made the report largely public. And I certainly do not question the Attorney General's good faith in that decision. Now, I hope and expect this to be the only time that I will speak to you in this manner. I am making that decision myself. No one has told me whether I can or should testify or speak further about this matter. There has been discussion about an appearance before Congress. Any testimony from this office would not go beyond our report. It contains our findings and analysis and the reasons for the decisions we made. We chose those words carefully, and the work speaks for itself. And the report is my testimony. I would not provide information beyond that which is already public in any appearance before Congress. In addition, access to our underlying work product is being decided in a process that does not involve our office. So beyond what I've said here today and what is contained in our written work, I do not believe it is appropriate for me to speak further about the investigation or to comment on the actions of the Justice Department or Congress. And it's for that reason I will not be taking questions today as well. Now, before I step away, I want to thank the attorneys, the FBI agents, the analysts, the professional staff who helped us conduct this investigation in a fair and independent manner. These individuals, who spent nearly 2 years with the special counsel's office, were of the highest integrity. And I will close by reiterating the central allegation of our indictments, that there were multiple systematic efforts to interfere in our election. And that allegation deserves the attention of every American. Thank you. Thank you for being here today.
Special Counsel Robert Mueller speaking for the very first time publicly.
That's Robert Mueller speaking in Washington, D.C. live. You heard it live, at least the last portion of it live. What Mueller essentially said was that Special Counsel Mueller says he's leaving the Justice Department now that he's concluded his Russian probe and going back to private life, and that the written report, the 400-some-page report that he gave earlier, will be his testimony. So we're not sure if that means that he's definitively saying no to testifying before Congress, but it sure seems that way, and we'll have more on it coming up at 11 o'clock on the MNF, or on 12 o'clock on the NPR News. Well, I'm Rob Lori. This is Radioactivity, and our first guest today is Howie Hawkins. He was the first U.S. candidate to campaign for a Green New Deal in 2010. He's also one of the original Greens in the U.S., having participated in the first national meeting to organize the U.S. Green Party in St. Paul, Minnesota in August 1984. In 2014, he received 5% of the vote in the New York gubernatorial race, the most for an independent Progressive Party candidate for governor in New York in almost 100 years. In April of this year, he announced he was forming a presidential exploratory committee as he considers seeking the Green Party line for president in 2020. His message is to create an eco-socialist economy that will reduce carbon emissions to net zero by 2030 and create millions of new green jobs. He'll be speaking this Sunday in Tampa, and he joins us on the phone right now. And welcome to WMNF. Howie, it's good to have you here.
It's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
All right. So, Howie, you were the first U.S. candidate to campaign for a Green New Deal back in 2010. Describe what the Green New Deal means to you.
Well, we came out of 2010 with the Green New Deal as a way to get out of the Great Recession. So it was both climate action and economic recovery. And by making a huge investment in transitioning rapidly to clean energy and reduce our carbon footprint, we would create millions of jobs and get the economy going. And so the way that we've sort of framed it since then is it's an economic bill of rights, the kind of thing that Franklin Roosevelt called for in his last two State of the Union addresses, 1944 and 45, asked Congress to enact. They never have. But everybody should have the right to a job, a living wage, a decent home, comprehensive health care, and a good education, good public education from preschool through college at public schools. And then the other piece of it is a big public investment in clean energy. So that is the nutshell of what we've called the Green New Deal. Now, we're talking about an eco-socialist Green New Deal because, look, Exxon and the Koch brothers are not going to reinvest their fossil fuel profits into renewable energy. We need to take them over like most countries have, taken over big oil, and then direct those earnings from fossil fuels in the transition into renewable energy. Same thing with the public power utility. We need to be able to move to clean renewable and invest in like retrofitting buildings with ground source heat pumps instead of relying on natural gas to heat in the north, particularly. So those kind of transitions require, you know, much more public ownership and democratic control than we've had over the energy sector. So that's the kind of thing that we're putting forward. And I'll just add to that that, you know, we appreciate that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and the Sunshine Movement that put the Green New Deal into the national spotlight. What we don't appreciate is they watered it down. You know, instead of 2030 as the deadline, it extended it to 2050. You know, and politicians, you give them a deadline that long, they're not going to do anything because it's somebody else's problem. Secondly, they got rid of the ban on fracking and new fossil fuel infrastructure. If we allow new fossil fuel infrastructure to be built, the investors expect to get a return on that for the next 40 years. We're locking ourselves into a climate holocaust. And finally, the resources, and more importantly, the technological know-how, the engineering know-how, is locked up in the military-industrial complex that we need to devote to this clean energy revolution. So military spending, which is so bloated and wasteful, we need to take some of that and put it into the Green New Deal. And that has been missing from the Democrats' Green New Deal in Congress, which the leadership shot down anyway. So our role in this campaign is to hold the Green New Deal to that standard and keep it in the debate.
Well, we're talking with Howie Hawkins, who wants to be the Green Party nominee for president next year. We're talking about his ideas for a Green New Deal. He was the first one to campaign on a Green New Deal, and this is WMNF in Tampa. So, Howie, on that first point that you want to take over the big oil companies, they're not going to do that without a fight. How do you propose to take over the big oil companies?
Well, we buy 51% of the stock. We can bond for it. And, you know, the people that lose their ownership will get paid off over time. But then we have control of the board. And we can change the mission so that they're devoted to a transition to clean energy instead of extracting every last profit they can from the exploitation of oil and gas and coal. So it's been done. Most countries in the world have nationalized their oil companies. We're exceptional in that regard. A lot of them got away with it in the post-Watergate period when the U.S. was too busy taking care of its own problems to go and intervene like they have many times, like going back to Iran in the early 50s. So, you know, it's something we've got to do if we're serious about making this transition. We can't, you know, the Koch brothers, they don't, that, you know, energy transition is the last thing they want to see.
So, Howie, if you buy up the oil companies and eventually the world turns away from fossil fuels for, you know, whatever reason, maybe the world says no to carbon dioxide pollution, or maybe it says these fuels are too dirty and too dangerous and we got to get a cleaner economy. At the end, when you use, I assume you're using public money to buy the stock of these companies, the stock is going to be worthless. So that money that you've invested in these big oil companies essentially it becomes nothing.
Well, as we approach nationalization, the stock's going to plummet. I mean, there are already Wall Street people saying, get out of fossils, because those assets that they use to evaluate the company, oil and gas, that will never be extracted because we can't afford to do it for climate reasons, means that they're way overvalued. And actually, the fossil fuel sector has been growing slower than most of the rest of the stock market. So, you know, once we talk about seriously taking it over, you know, the smart investors are going to get out, the price is going to come down, so it won't cost us as much. But there are assets besides the stranded assets of oil and gas we'll never extract, and those are the pipelines, the refineries, all those parts. And, you know, we're going to use those in the transition. We're not going to get off oil and gas in a day. It's just that the money we earn from the sale of those fossil fuels should be reinvested in renewables instead of more oil extraction. So, look, it is going to be expensive to make this transition. But what will be more expensive is if we don't, because then global warming, ecosystem collapse, food production collapse, leading to civilization collapse. That's what we're facing. This is an existential threat. And to say we can't afford it, no, it'll cost us more if we don't do it.
Howie Hawkins is our guest. He's with the Green Party. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa. So, Howie, I want to play for you what President Trump said after Congresswoman AOC announced the Green Deal, her version of the Green Deal, earlier this year. This is what President Trump said back in March. I want to get your response to it.
Last week, they introduced a massive government takeover that would destroy our incredible economic gains. They introduced the so-called Green New Deal. It sounds like a high school term paper that got a low mark. It would shut down American energy, which I don't think the people in Texas are going to be happy with that. It would shut down a little thing called air travel. How do you take a train to Europe? You know, this crazy senator from Hawaii, they said, do you like it? Yes, I like it very much. Oh, really? How are we getting to Hawaii on a train? She didn't think about that one, but she's thinking about it. She'll figure it out. They want to take away your car, reduce the value of your home, and put millions of Americans out of work, spend $100 trillion, which, by the way, there's no such thing as $100 trillion. You have to spend $100 trillion. And remember this, no other country except us is going to do it. That's a little problem, too.
President Trump, earlier this year, you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. So, Howie Hawkins of the Green Party, what would you say to the president about that? He says the Green New Deal would take away your car, would cost $100 trillion. There would no longer be airplane travel. It would shut down the American energy system. What would you say back to the president?
You're a liar. Trump, you're a liar. You should be impeached. Lying is the least of your crimes. I mean, this guy's making that stuff up. $100 trillion? He exaggerated from a right-wing think tank that made it up. They came up with $93 trillion. I mean, you can't believe a word this man says. And there are more jobs in clean energy than there are in fossil fuels. He talked about Texas. Wind generation, that's where they're getting most of their electricity. They're exporting their oil and gas. Sure, that's good for the Texas economy, but this guy doesn't know what he's talking about. He calls global warming a Chinese hoax. He's an idiot. So that's my answer to him.
Are any other countries, I mean, the president was indicating that no other country was taking the global warming issue seriously, that we would be the only ones really attacking it. Is he accurate in saying that we would be the only country really dealing with global warming?
No. I mean, China's the one they always talk about. China's got the solar collectors and the wind generators. The Green New Deal I'm talking about is going to rebuild manufacturing in this country, starting from the machine tool industry, which is the core of manufacturing. Without that, you can't really do intermediate and consumer goods. Our machine tool industry is gone because of the policies of both parties. And Trump isn't rebuilding it despite all the stuff he says. It's going to take public investment. We're going to do like we did during World War II. To turn industry in a dime in order to build the arsenal for democracy that defeated the Nazis, federal government either took over or built a quarter of U.S. manufacturing capacity. The only difference this time is, when we build that those Green New Deal factories, which we want to put in every congressional district, we're going to turn them over to the workers instead of the super rich and their corporations, which we did after World War II. Turn them over to workers as worker-owned cooperatives that they will manage, and that will spread the wealth around, and everybody will benefit. That's the kind of Green New Deal we're talking about. Now, the politics of it, I mean, he spoke those lies before what happened last weekend. The European elections, what happened? The Green surge. And they ran on the Green New Deal. And the Trumpist ultra-right underperformed. And it was the Green New Deal program, a program of hope, a positive program of hope, beat that negative program of fear based on racism and xenophobia and religious bigotry, fact-free irrationalism and authoritarianism. That is Trumpism. And the European version of it lost to the Green New Deal last weekend in Europe. So that's what I say, you know, to the Trump people. You've got a losing program. You're not positive about, all you can talk about is what's wrong with us. And this is the country that, you know, has had so many inventions. We can show the world how to do a Green New Deal and the economic benefits. Countries are going to want to copy us. So, yeah, he's crazy.
Howie, what about air travel? What will happen? Because airplanes do contribute a lot to global warming. What would you do about air travel under the Green New Deal?
Well, short term, you can do biofuels, which instead of the carbon recycles. So you burn it, goes in the atmosphere, then you grow the crops from which you develop the biofuels, like ethanol. Virgin Airlines, forget the leader of it, you know, is working on that. So there are ways to make it less impactful. Hydrogen fuel is something that's been talked about, and that is basically a way of storing energy that you create in other ways, and then you use it to, you know, power machinery, including jet engines. That is something we haven't developed. We're isn't at the practical stage, but it's something we might look at. We're not getting rid of air travel, but, you know, within the United States, you know, take a bullet train, a high-speed train, which China has, Japan has, Europe has, and even Trump was complaining about the third-world status of some of our, he was talking about airports, but our infrastructure. I mean, that's a big part of the Green New Deal. We're going to bring back light rail, mass transit, freight rails for, you know, trucking to replace a lot of the trucking of, machine parts and food and whatever else we're, you know, bringing down the highways. And then for intermediate range travel between cities, high-speed rail. And it's a lot easier to get in and out of a train station than a airport. Because you got to park and, you know, you need a lot of room for the runways. A train can go right into the center of the city so we can re-densify cities and end the sprawl and create walkable communities around the spokes and hubs of the rail system. I mean, that's the kind of thing we're talking about with the Green New Deal. We're going to improve transportation. Now, where air travel is the only way, I got four cousins in Hawaii, and I'm not taking a slow boat next time I go to visit them. I'm going to fly. I'm going to have no problem with it. So we're not getting rid of air travel. We're just going to make the whole transportation system more rational.
less environmentally damaging.
Our guest is Howie Hawkins, and for more than 30 years, he's been an activist in the Green Party, and this year, he's considering running for the Green Party nomination for president in next year's election. Howie, we just have about 2 minutes left, but let me ask you about the Green Party. I mean, I think it's fair to say that its heyday was that 2000 election with Ralph Nader. What shape is the Green Party in these days, and does it have the power to attract many voters in the U.S.?
Well, we have a big influence in the states where we're best organized. We have over 100 elected officials, which is more than any third party in the country. We survived 30 years when a lot of efforts that progressive third parties have come and gone. So we're here to stay. I think we're poised on growth. We saw this weekend what happened in Europe. The other part of the European story is that the major parties in the center, you know, the Labor Social Democratic parties on one side, the Christian Democratic Conservative parties on the other side, they lost votes to the Greens and also some votes to the far right, which didn't do as well as the Greens on the left. So, you know, the system that we have, the two-party system, you know, it's not working for about half the people who don't vote in federal elections. They're disgusted with both parties. That's who we're trying to bring into the process. So I think we're poised on the edge of a lot of growth. And one of the purposes of this campaign, by the way, I announced yesterday in Brooklyn that I am seeking, I've decided to seek the Green Party nomination. So I'm past the exploratory phase. And one of the major things we're going to be doing this year before the convention next year is getting the Greens on the ballot. This country has the worst laws for getting on the ballot of any electoral democracy in the world. I don't care whether you're talking about India, Russia, Mexico, Canada, United Kingdom. They need a fraction of the signatures that we do to get on the ballot. And that's part of the way the two-party system maintains itself. So we have ballots in about 30 states. We need ballots in another 31, counting the District of Columbia. And one of the purposes is not just so we can have a presidential candidate, but so we can have down ballot candidates, because we're going to build this green alternative from the bottom up. City councils, school boards, then state legislatures, then Congress. And by the time we get to that point, when a green runs for president, they'll have to be covered because we got a caucus in Congress and we're part of the national debate already. So that's what we're planning to do and have a big impact.
Howie, do you have a website?
Yeah, HowieHawkins.us will get you to the website, and you can see there more about what I have to say about the issues and the news coverage we've had. And also, if you want, you can volunteer and donate.
Howie Hawkins, thanks a lot for coming on WMNF. Great to have you here.
It was great to be here. Thanks very much.
All right, thanks. Howie Hawkins is running for the Green Party nomination for president. He'll be speaking this Sunday at 11 a.m. at the American Legion Hall on North Florida Avenue in Tampa, 6918 North Florida Avenue in Tampa. And he has been an activist in the Green Party since 1984. Well, you're listening to 88.5 FM. This is WMNF in Tampa. Just reading from the wire service right now. And regarding the statement by Robert Mueller, Special Counsel Robert Mueller is not ruling out testifying before Congress, but is serving notice that he does not intend to go beyond what has already been revealed in his report. Mueller said this morning that he and the Special Counsel team chose their words carefully in the report, and the work speaks for itself. Mueller says that the report is his testimony, and that he would not provide information beyond that which is already public in any appearance before Congress. He says that beyond what he said in his public statement and in his written work, he doesn't believe it is appropriate for him to speak further about the investigation. So we'll have more on the Mueller report at the top of the hour. This is 88.5 FM WMNF in Tampa. We're going to speak with the leader of the group that is the opposite of the Federalist Society in just a moment. Music from Oliver Mitsikudzi. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa. Well, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said yesterday if a Supreme Court vacancy occurs during next year's presidential election, he would work to confirm a nominee appointed by President Trump. That is a move that is in sharp contrast to his decision to block President Obama's nominee to the High Court following the death of Justice Antonin Scalia in February of 2016. At that time, McConnell cited the right of voters in the presidential election to decide whether a Democrat or a Republican president would fill that opening, a move that infuriated Democrats. McConnell was speaking at the Paducah Chamber of Commerce luncheon yesterday in Kentucky. He was asked by an attendee, should a Supreme Court justice die next year, what will your position be on filling that spot?
Last week.
Sandra, I couldn't hear that.
If the Supreme Court justice
was to
die next year, what would you do?
We'd fill it. the reason I started with the judges, as important as all these other things are that we're talking about, I mean, if you want to have a long-lasting, positive impact on the country, everything else changes. You know, I remember during the tax bill, there were people agonizing over whether one part of the tax bill was permanent or not. I said, look, the only way the tax bill is permanent depends upon the next election. The next election. Because people have different views about taxes in the two parties and approach it differently when they get in power. What can't be undone is a lifetime appointment to a young man or woman who believes in the quaint notion that the job of the judge is to follow the law. So that's the most important thing we've done for the country, which cannot be undone.
Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, speaking yesterday in Kentucky. Well, our next guest is Caroline Fredrickson. She's the author of The Democracy Fix, How to Win the Fight for Fair Rules, Fair Courts, and Fair Elections. She's the president of the American Constitution Society, and she joins us on the phone right now. And Caroline, welcome to WMNF. Good to have you here.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I want to ask you about what Senator McConnell said yesterday. What do you make of that?
Well, you know, nobody should be surprised. I'm certainly not surprised. I could have told you as soon as he said that President Obama could not fill the seat that he would assume that any Republican president could fill any seat at any time. You know, he's made clear it's outcomes that matter to him. It's not process. It's not some perceived fairness. What he wants is a very, very right-wing court. He made that clear in his answer to the question that you just played from the Paducah Chamber of Commerce, that, you know, the courts are lasting. Legislative victories are fleeting.
So when McConnell said, if you want to have a long-lasting impact on the country, appoint a judge for a lifetime appointment, that has a long-lasting impact. How successful have conservatives like McConnell been in appointing lifetime judges in the last few years?
Devastatingly. You know, this is an area, and I talk about this in my book, The Democracy Fix, where the right has been focused like a laser beam for decades on the courts. State courts, federal courts, the trial courts, the appeals courts, the Supreme Court. They have been focused on developing a conservative cohort of young people to be nominated and confirmed with extremely right-wing views that have driven our courts in a rightward direction. You know, and you can, you know, people who follow the decisions of the court can speak to this. Because you've seen in area after area where the left has been focused on the legislative battles, which, as McConnell notes, can be changed at the next election, the right has been focused on fixing their gains for the long term. And so they have been taking over the courts and undoing voting rights successes, undoing women's access to reproductive rights, blocking Democratic efforts to expand the franchise, to limit gerrymandering, and we see this as it goes on and on. And, you know, one of the things that I think should be terrifying to people is that we have a president who's unstable, to say the least, questions democracy constantly, admires dictators, and if he loses the election, and, you know, and Florida is kind of the epicenter of this, right? I mean, imagine there's a challenge to the outcome in Florida. You know, you all better than almost anyone remember Bush v. Gore. He's locking in a court that can have a Trump versus whoever, and we know what the outcome of that's going to be. So I think we all need to be terrified about what's happening to our democracy when the courts are moved in such a rightward direction.
All right, so if the courts are moving in the rightward direction, I hear this talk about the Federalist Society all the time, which is an association of judges and lawyers. Is the Federalist Society the sort of minor leagues for wannabe conservative judges?
Well, it's the major leagues. I mean, they have really been aggressive, and the man who's most well known from the Federalist Society, Leonard Leo, has been extremely outspoken at what he desires. He wants a court that is reflective of where this country was in the early 20th century. So before the New Deal, certainly before the Civil Rights Movement, way before the Women's Rights Movement, he wants to undo all of those gains. He's fiercely anti-choice. He has claimed as his highest goal is to have Roe versus Wade overturned. He is very opposed to voting rights. You know, the Voting Rights Act has been chipped away at and was given a devastating blow by the Roberts Court, the Shelby County decision, and now they want to end it completely. And, you know, there are a number of other areas, including, you know, ensuring that, you know, we don't face, you know, an environmental tragedy. They want to undo the ability of the government to make sure we have clean water and clean air and that, you know, Florida coastlines aren't eaten away by high tides, you know, to protect us from pollution and from climate change, and then all of that is a target of this effort to move the courts to the right. And the Federalist Society, as I said, it's not just a minor league. Well, they certainly are the minor league. I mean, they cultivate, starting with law students or before, you know, very convinced conservatives who want to move this country back 100 years. Just like Leonard Leo, but they move them through law school and into law practice and then to become judges. So it's sort of, they've got farm teams and they got the major leagues. And, you know, it's an area where the left and progressive generally and moderates who should care about having a fair court system really need to be up in arms and make sure that we have an equal or greater investment in ensuring that we have fair-minded judges and fair courts for all Americans.
Well, our guest is Caroline Fredrickson. She's the author of the new book, The Democracy Fix, How to Win the Fight for Fair Rules, Fair Courts, and Fair Elections. And she is the president of the American Constitution Society. We'll talk more about that in just a moment. So, Caroline, if the Federalist Society is the major leagues, the pipeline that puts these conservative judges on the benches around the country, how are they funded?
Well, you know, what you're probably guessing is right, that they are a major recipient of dark money from the various plutocrats on the right, from the Koch brothers, the Mercers, the Bradleys, you know, that they are those billionaires who are heavily invested in preventing the forward movement of this country and preventing expansion of the right to vote, and preventing their companies from being regulated. You know, the Koch brothers in particular, you know, have their oil money is where they come from. They want to make sure that they can continue to exploit the environmental and create negative environmental impact without any cost to themselves. And that's one reason that they understand that the courts are a major focus for that, and with the kind of the ideology that's pushed by the Federalist Society and their allies, you know, regulation is highly suspect. That means the rest of us get dirty air and dirty water, and the Koch brothers take home billions of dollars.
You're the president of the American Constitution Society. If you were to look at your resources, what you have at your fingertips and how you're able to recruit, I assume that you want to recruit liberal, progressive, more moderate judges, and correct me if I'm wrong. How would you compare your resources to those of the Federalist Society?
Well, you know, it's a good question. We obviously don't have those same resources. I mean, we depend on a much broader array of supporters. You know, we don't have the these right-wing billionaires funneling us money for decades. And so, you know, we have to fight harder. But we have the people on our side. And I think, what's really vital to our efforts is that we are representative of the future. I mean, what we're looking to do as we gather and nurture the next generation of legal leaders is to make sure that the legal leaders are much more reflective of the America that we are and are becoming, that we have a diverse group of nominees, that they come from different communities as well as have different areas of practice. So we don't need just simply prosecutors and corporate lawyers, but also public defenders and people who lawyers who represent people who've been harmed. So it's a real broad-based effort. That's who's behind us. It means that we don't have as much money, but we have a lot more. I think we have the futures on our side. But, you know, the one thing we really have to do is to convince progressives and moderates that, you know, all the two-thirds of the political spectrum need to pay a lot more attention to the courts, because that small minority on the right that really believes, and Leonard Leo has said this explicitly, that everything after, you know, the beginning of the 20th century was wrong in America. He wants us to take us back to that era when everything was completely unregulated, when you couldn't have a minimum wage, when child labor was permissible and couldn't be regulated, when women had no control over their bodies, when women couldn't vote. That's what his ideal is. That's what these people are pushing for. And if the rest of us don't start to pay attention and invest the resources, both the time and the money, to make sure that we have a counter effort, that we have a plan to move good, fair-minded judges through the system. We need to reclaim our country, because otherwise, it's going to be a very different place that we'll be living in. And remember, those judicial appointments on the federal level, those are for life.
Caroline Fredrickson is our guest, and her book is The Democracy Fix. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa. Okay, so if the Federalist Society and its Vice President Leonard Leo wants to go back to that era before the minimum wage, before unemployment insurance, before Social Security and Medicare, before union protection, before the beginning of civil rights protections and gender rights protections, before an era where we had no ban on child labor laws, where we had a work week that could last for some people 60 or 80 hours, I mean, that was an era where business ruled and what we now call corporations ruled. I mean, it would seem to be that would be a formula for dismantling the middle class that we have.
Well, exactly. No, it's exactly right. And you know, this is that's sort of the formula that you mentioned. Is, you know, that is one of the reasons why the Chamber of Commerce, and you know, you just played that clip of Mitch McConnell speaking in front of his local chamber, but the National Chamber has been part of this effort for a long time, really from the beginning of when it was plotted out, and I described this in my book in 1971, where the future Supreme Court Justice Lewis Powell drafted a memo to the chamber about, you know, what he described as a frontal attack on capitalism, because, you know, all of a sudden corporations were not allowed to kill people who bought their cars. Remember, you know, Ralph Nader sued the car companies for putting out extremely dangerous cars, and they weren't allowed to pollute, you know, just as much as they wanted. And the country started to demand environmental protections, and the EPA was set up. It was even set up by Richard Nixon, and he thought this meant that, you know, it was the end of capitalism as we know it. So he organized the corporations and the business leaders, you know, behind an effort to stack the courts with right-wingers, and they made kind of a devil's bargain with the far right on social issues, knowing that it's easier to rally people around, abortion or school prayer or something like that than it is to rally them around, you know, policies that are going to actually be bad for them. You know, these sort of, the Reagan Democrats, as they were called, it's hard to rally them around, corporate, tax cuts that are going to decimate social programs these people benefit from. Instead, they rallied them around, you know, the social agenda. They've been, you know, in the tank for, you know, then these many decades of building this process, supporting and financing an effort to ensure that the right is going to dominate the court system, both in the state elections and in the federal appointments process.
But, I can hear people objecting, saying, well, look, who in their right mind would want to dismantle the American middle class? Why would anybody want to do that? I mean, if that's what happens, if you undo the Great Society programs, and if you undo the programs that fought the Great Depression under Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and if you undo the laws breaking up the segregated schools in the 1950s, we go back to an era where money rules and the people have no, you know, protection against the power of big money. I mean, who would actually want to go there?
You wouldn't think so. But nonetheless, and unfortunately, these people are ideologues. They have a firm notion that the regulatory state as we know it, which is, you know, a terminology for everything you described, for Social Security, for minimum wage protection, for bans on child labor, for controls on pollution from factories and making sure that our water is drinkable. That's all to them, illegitimate, unconstitutional, and needs to be dismantled. And, I think we all know that we live in a dystopia. Were that to happen, it would be, you know, a country that would be unlivable for most of us, and yet nonetheless, they pursue this effort. And you can already see, you know, to the extent that, the Trump administration has been dismantling environmental protection aggressively, as well as in other areas. And the Labor Department has had so many of its rules rolled back that were, you know, basic minimal protections for workers. They were not anything at all aggressive or radical. They were just, you know, but in any case, this has been, this is their agenda. And I think, you know, even for those plutocrats and billionaires who somehow think that they should fund these efforts, you know, one can only imagine it's going to would be bad for them in the long term in their financial interest not to have a resilient middle class. Ideology seems to be winning out over common sense. And I think, again, it's very dangerous for all of us, but the writing's on the wall. I mean, they have announced it. And as you mentioned, you know, segregated schools, that's the Brown v. Board decision. Trump's nominees for the courts are not willing to say that they support that decision. I mean, that is truly radical. That was an area where, you know, all nominees would say, okay, if there's one thing settled under the law, that's that Brown versus Board of Education was properly decided and that segregation is illegal. Well, not anymore.
Well, Caroline Frederickson is here. She's written a new book called The Democracy Fix. Your book is not entirely dark and depressing, Caroline. You have some ideas about how to fix this. So let's talk about some of your six main points for making our democracy more responsive to the people.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think there's some clear things, and Florida, you know, has already taken some steps. So one is to make sure that we have fair elections. That is ensuring that the systems are accessible to all eligible voters, expanding the electorate by, you know, for example, making sure that people who've served their time can restore their rights and participate in the system. That's obviously hit a bit of a roadblock in Florida, but that's incredibly important. Making it easier to register to vote, online voter registration, automatic voter registration when you sign up for a government service or get your driver's license, expanding early voting. But we also need fair districts. We cannot have politicians, and I mean Democrats as well as Republicans, deciding how to draw their own district. Incumbents are biased here. What matters is what the people want, what the voters want, and districts should be drawn in the fairest way to ensure representation is democratic and not biased in favor of incumbents.
Let me stop you right there. I mean, it's interesting because we'll be going through the census and then the redistricting process here in the next couple of years in Florida, as every state will do. We now have a 7-2 conservative majority on the Florida Supreme Court. In the past, the Florida Supreme Court has looked at partisan redistricting and taken somewhat of a strong stand on partisan redistricting. Now with a conservative majority on the court and Republicans controlling Tallahassee, our state capital, they're going to be able to draw whatever plan they want and not get much pushback from the Florida Supreme Court. And that goes to your point about the importance of judgeships, that when you elect a governor or when you elect a president, that president has a lot of power to put people in place almost permanently.
Exactly. Well, so that, you know, you bring me to my next point, which is we cannot allow ourselves, people who are anywhere to the left of Genghis Khan, you know, we cannot ignore the courts as we have for too long and let this minority of extreme right-wingers dominate, because the courts are such a vital place for decisions like this to be made. Can we have fair districts in America? Can we have districts that are not drawn to favor the interests of that party that's in power to benefit incumbents at the expense of our democracy and at the expense of the voters' interests? You know, that's so critical. Will we have laws that protect the right to vote or access to basic health care? You know, that is all upended when we don't pay attention to the courts and focus only on elections. And so, you know, I hope your listeners will really make sure to pay attention to what's going on in the Florida courts, to make sure that they're voting based on who the judges are, or who's going to appoint them, and what their stated positions are on these key issues, because, you know, Florida really has suffered from elections that have been in such turmoil. And, you know, if any state deserves to have a good and fair system that can't be manipulated by politicians, but in fact is there to serve the voters, you know, you guys deserve it. And I hope you're going to be successful in fighting for it.
Now, one of your 6 points is to reform voting laws to energize democratic participation and win elections. How do you energize democratic participation by reforming voting laws?
Well, I mean, ensuring that it's not a frustrating process to try and vote. I mean, we make it so hard to vote. All sorts of efforts that start months before the election day that inhibit people's ability to get on the rolls, and then we strip people from the rolls inappropriately. There are all sorts of ways that people, you know, who want to vote find that their abilities have been restricted. So, you know, that is demoralizing. People decide not to show up. The voter suppression on top of that, when people are told that, you know, that they'll be harassed at the polling place or efforts, you know, and Karl Rove was a Republican, still is a Republican operative, you know, was famous for running campaigns that, you know, told people that Election Day had been moved or, you know, that there would be cops waiting outside the polling place to check anybody who had unpaid parking tickets and things like that. I mean, it's a classic move from these right-wing interests to try and make sure that especially minority voters are harassed and prevented from voting. So part of it is, you know, when people are sure that the system is fair and that their vote is going to count, they're energized because they feel like it's a valuable part of their civic duty. When they feel like it just makes, you know, it's just hard. It's an incredible challenge to get there, that their votes, you know, may not be counted. You know, that causes people not to show up. And that is causes real harm to our democracy.
So, Caroline, you say that the left needs to have a strong media hub to generate content. And unlike the right, you say the left should not use lies and distortion. Some conservatives would say, well, the left has NBC or the New York Times or, National Public Radio, and therefore the left already has a media outlet. Is that your idea of what a left media outlet might
say? No, it's kind of like saying that university professors tend to be liberal, and therefore, you know, students are indoctrinated. you know, I guess you could say generally journalists maybe more, you know, somewhere moderate to a little bit on the left. But that doesn't mean that, you know, good journalists are pushing an agenda. Good journalists are supposed to be telling you what's happening in the world. And I think that's still true of the sources that, of the sites that you mentioned, of the Times and the NPR and the others, that they're actually, you know, trying to cover the news. And they were pretty hard on Obama when they wanted to be. I mean, they covered, you know, their opinion pages, criticized him, and their news covered, you know, things that went wrong on his watch. You know, in contrast, you've got Fox News and the whole kind of media infrastructure on the right, which pushes, you know, stories that are just false. You know, for example, the whole, you know, President Obama was not born in the United States. He was born in Kenya. You know, what's called the birther kind of lie that Donald Trump ran with. That was all over Fox News. They kept repeating it. And, you know, the, you know, Rush Limbaugh and, you know, the others. And, you know, there was an echo chamber that repeats these lies and until people start to think they're true. And I don't think that's that's not a road that I think, you know, any news organization should go down. But I do think that as sort of the progressive, organized progressive, not the news media, but, you know, sort of the organizations and the party, you know, need to think about how to talk to people in a more compelling way. And, you know, one of the points I make is that, you know, we have some really great entertainers and comedians, you know, who are generally progressive. You got Samantha Bee, Stephen Colbert, you know, and so forth. Trevor Noah, you know, these are people who can really illustrate what's going wrong with this country. So why can't we use some of that humor, some of that brilliance to actually drive a message that leads to change as opposed to just a message that makes people laugh?
Now, here's a question from one of our listeners. Suzanne writes, I never used to vote on local judges because I didn't know anything about them. If you go to their webpage, it's all good news. How do you find unbiased and truthful information about judges for local elections? And I'll just add this. How do you make sure that you're not electing a Federalist to a judgeship? If that's your preference, I mean, you might be a conservative and you want to elect a Federalist. But let's say for those who are progressive and liberal that don't want to elect a Federalist, how do you find out?
Well, it's a really great question, and I think there are different sources. You know, so for one, the local bar association may be a place where they have reviews of judges. The League of Women Voters. I would look at other groups that do election work in your area who are focused on local elections. If you're a Democrat, ask the Democratic Party. If you're an independent, look to see what both parties are saying about the candidates. Look online to see if there are articles about them. I think, you know, it's a little bit harder than some of the other races, for sure. And we need to get better about making sure there's more information. But I encourage people to dig in a little bit. But, you know, start with those resources. And you should get a sense of you know, what the judges are all about. You know, I think if you look at their contributors, too. If they're running for election, you should be able to see who's giving them money. And that might give you some sense, too, of what their interests are. And, you know, it's an unfortunate thing. I, you know, personally don't think that we should elect judges at all, because the idea that a judge is taking money from some interest that might appear before him or her in the courtroom, sometimes as soon as the next day after a fundraiser, is really kind of disquieting, to say the least, and dismaying that our justice system could be influenced by money.
Yeah, I've seen that up close.
On,
all right, Caroline, we're almost out of time. We're almost out of time. We just have about 30 seconds. But if there are local lawyers who want to join the American Constitution Society, how can they join?
Well, you should go right to our website, www.acslaw.org, and find and join there, but also sign up for our, we have several chapters in Florida, including in Tampa.
All right. Well, Caroline Fredrickson, thanks a lot. Author of The Democracy Fix and the president of the American Constitution Society. Thanks for coming on WMNF.
Hey, it was really a pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks, Caroline. Take care. And if you want to comment about today's show, you can call us up at 813-238-8001. Record your comment on extension 115, and I'll play your comments back tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. Now stay tuned for NOLA. He's coming up on the Midpoint program. First, we're going to get the NPR News and their report on what Robert Mueller had to say at his statement earlier this morning in Washington, D.C. I'm Rob Lurie. This is WMNF in Tampa. Thanks to Ed Green for being